Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Brandon Thurston from Wrestlenomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And it is time for Pollock and Thurston. I am John Pollock, joined as always by Brandon Thurston, where he is coming from the Wrestlenomics home headquarters.
Library. I'm in the library today.
Oh, the National Wrestlenomics Archives.
Yes, yes. We've been going through some of the records today.
Okay. Well, we're going to go through plenty of records today. We have it all on today's show. We're going to be going through what is next for Vince McMahon, plus lawsuits galore. We have a lawsuit uncovered from several months ago that we'll be discussing in relation to Game Changer Wrestling. We have John Moxley and AEW being sued over an incident from 2 years ago. But we're going to talk about everyone's favorite topic, the politicization of WWE/TKO.
I think we're going to talk about five different lawsuits today.
Five?
I think so.
Yes. Yes, we have motions that have been refiled. Janelle Grant, the Ring Boy lawsuit. I mean, this is where you come for the deep dives into all pro wrestling related lawsuits. Lots to get into today.
You'll basically have an LSAT score by the end of this program.
Well, Brandon, first we are going to be discussing the difference between a rally and a anniversary celebration. What are the differences? The line was blurred 6 days ago when your current sitting president, Donald Trump, appeared at Fort Bragg, and he was bragging about the fact that they are back to being identified as Fort Bragg. Now, before we even get into all of this, what in God's name are you two doing talking about politics? What does this have to do with WWE, Brandon? Why are we forcing politics onto our audience today?
Well, Cody Rhodes, Tiffany Stratton, and the Street Profits all appeared at Fort Bragg. This was, what day of the week was this? This was on the 10th. Is that right? So the 10th was, that was last week, Tuesday. So we really should have talked about this last week. But they all appeared at Fort Bragg, which is, you know, this is the same thing that the military parade was about over the weekend. It's the 250th anniversary, the 250th birthday of the Army, the strongest military foot force in all of the world. And it was just a get together for the Army and to celebrate the Army. Nothing different from the tribute to all of the tribute to the troops, not only the events, but all the morale visits, the morale boosts that WWE has done through their community outreach over the years. So why are you making such a big deal about this?
Yeah. I mean, let's be fair. WWE didn't make a big deal out of this. I mean, there were no highlights of this showing on SmackDown, on Raw, like nothing about their just, this is just an apolitical event. We are just sending some talent to go sing happy birthday to the Army. But of course, as is natural in this current administration, there were some concerns coming out of this particular event. Let's hear from that.
We thank you from the absolute bottom of our hearts. Few places loom larger in Army lore than where we are gathered today, the one and only Fort Bragg, the one and only Fort Bragg.
It looks like a campaign event, but this is an official presidential visit to Fort Bragg to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army.
The Army historically has bent over backwards to maintain an apolitical image.
Bainin looked into who was chosen to sit behind the president. Internal communication within the 82nd Airborne Division outlined specific directives. Those include soldiers sitting in the bleachers are to be fit and not look fat. And soldiers with political views in opposition who don't want to be there need to get swapped out.
Well, but even went a step further. There was a Trump merchandise shop, this whole like pop-up shop. It's called Campaign 365 that was selling T-shirts and tchotchkes and all sorts of memorabilia.
In a statement to WREL, an 18th Airborne Corps spokesperson wrote, "The Army does not endorse political merchandise or the views it represents. The vendor's presence is under review to determine how it was permitted and to prevent similar occurrences in the future."
So not heard there as well were parts of Donald Trump's speech that, as NBC News noted, other Trump comments about the fake news media, transgender people, protesters in California, and flag burning also drew boos from the uniformed military members in attendance. This coming after the same military members could be seen very visibly booing references to Joe Biden, California Governor Gavin Newsom, and L.A. Mayor Karen Bass. And this is like a pretty stunning photo just in and of itself, seeing that this backdrop of everyone like army members with their phones out hooting and hollering the president here. Now, I will state flat out, like, am I stating that this is a, you know, existential moment for WWE? It's not. I think on their surface, they could have thought the idea that this is more so a less, I imagine they would not have thought that this was going to be as politicized an event. Maybe I'm giving too much leeway. But regardless, I think that this is one where if you are just simply painting this as some neutral celebration of the army, that's not what this was last week. And there's been a lot of fire coming out of this, and the conduct of these military members that, like, when you are in uniform, like, this is very beyond the pale of any kind of political stance you should be demonstrating.
Yeah, I think this will be lost on a lot of people, especially in the years since Trump has been president and has gone against a lot of norms that other presidents have respected. I remember when George W. Bush was president and there were all the military actions in Iraq and Afghanistan. Bush would speak with military troops in uniform probably a lot, but what he wasn't doing was saying, you know, John Kerry is doing bad stuff, or I beat Al Gore, or Al Gore is lying, and then having the troops in uniform behind him reacting in support of him. It's extremely unusual and against Department of Defense regulations to, for example, attend a political rally in uniform. That's not something you're supposed to do, and there might be serious consequences if you do that, but apparently not for this Department of Defense. Pete Hegseth, who is the Secretary of Defense, was there at this event as well. So point being, this is more along the lines of what a North Korea would do in terms of having the military show that they're not just in support of the country or of the military, of the people that they work with, but of partisan politics, booing along with comments, rhetoric that's made against Democratic governors like Gavin Newsom, against former Democratic presidents like Joe Biden. That's what's unusual about this. And whether or not WWE knew, whether or not Cody and Tiffany Stratton and the Street Profits knew it was going to be like this ahead of time, that's what it was. And they're associated with that.
I think it speaks volumes of the fact that there was no quick clip of this on SmackDown. Like, this would be the type of an event that they would, I think, place a spotlight on. Like, here are some of our stars. It's a, you know, it's here just under the guise of celebrating the army, which is, you know, what they were ultimately sent to do here. But this became an extremely politicized event, and there was no focus of this by WWE. And it more so just kind of builds a furthering of this increased political identity that WWE and TKO have always had behind the scenes, very much front and center for UFC, but not so much for WWE. And when you see instances like this was followed up with a very public meeting that RFK Jr. had with Paul Levesque and Stephanie McMahon last week, where Robert Kennedy Jr. posted that he met today with Triple H and Stephanie McMahon to strategize about the upcoming President's Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition. And Paul Levesque responding, "Thank you for having us, Secretary Kennedy. Always striving to do whatever we can to help make our nation's youth as healthy as they can be." Get the brain worms out. That's the initiative here for Paul Levesque and company here with RFK Jr. And this got the response you would probably assume that it would. And then compounded in all of this, okay, you guys are just reaching too much here. I tune into WWE programming. I'm not littered with these politics. Keep it out of my wrestling. Well, folks, you can't even get that far away from it, because the whole focus of our next PLE, Night of Champions, is built around a CM Punk tweet from several years ago.
"I use CM Punk's rebellious nature and sociopathic self-confidence to back him into a corner, where now, if CM Punk really wants to take this, he has to admit to himself that he's a hypocrite."
Yes, and not knowing is if there will be a brand new CM Punk blood-covered dick shirt coming out in advance of Night of Champions coming up on June the 28th. But this is literally the storyline. And last,
they're not explicitly acknowledging the tweet, though, right?
They have not. Well, I mean, as much as being a hypocrite is, I mean, that's,
they're not going to put blood-covered dick on their TV show, I guess.
They're basically telling your audience, go Google CM Punk hypocrite, and we are one degree away from acknowledging it on screen. But this is the story, is that John Cena is willing to give CM Punk his elusive title shot, but in order to do that, he has to jeopardize his past moral standing of having a standing against the Saudi Arabian government by going to said country in order to secure this title shot. He has to mortgage his character for this title shot. That's the storyline going into Night of Champions. So, like, it is left to the audience to essentially read between the lines that they have painted Saudi Arabia as this oppressive regime that your top babyface is opposed to, but also very much diminishing, I think, the stature of a CM Punk to your audience's eyes here by, well, he is, this title shot comes with consequences, and I've got to suck it up and go on this flight to Saudi Arabia, where I can only hope when he lands in Saudi Arabia that there's someone to pick him up there at the airport to get him to the arena.
I hope so.
I hope he doesn't have to take the subway.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what will be. So that's, what is it? What is the date of this? I got it on the screen.
It's a week from Saturday.
June 28th. Hopefully, there will be peace in the Middle East by then. Not that I necessarily expect Riyadh to be, and this is in Riyadh, not Jeddah?
Yes, Riyadh.
Yeah. Not that I expect Riyadh to necessarily be in danger related to what's going on in Iran. But I mean, like, along the lines of the partisan politics, I think there's, and we saw in the build up to WrestleMania that Paul Levesque was saying positive things about Trump. His mother-in-law is in the cabinet, is the Secretary of Education. So he seems to be more outwardly supportive of the Trump administration.
Spent New Year's Eve at Mar-a-Lago. I mean,
right.
Like, Paul Levesque is not certainly, you know, withheld his, you know, he is very much adjacent to this administration through his mother-in-law. And I mean, directly in this case, where he's taking meetings with RFK Jr.
And I think Nick Khan's political expressions have been more subtle. And he's, if you look at his FEC record, he's given to candidates from both parties, I think more so Democrats. But nonetheless, when he was on with Bill Simmons and lead up to WrestleMania, he was even, you know, in a way saying nice things about Trump. And I think it's just reflective of what you're seeing throughout major corporations, where everyone is, you know, has calculated that it's in their interests, in their shareholder interests to flatter this administration, because that's very important to this administration in terms of avoiding undesirable consequences and in terms of, you know, attracting desirable consequences.
Yeah. If you're just rooting for civil chaos within TKO, then you're definitely backing Rahm Emanuel as the Democratic nominee in 2028, correct? Like that would just put our world just off its axis at that point.
Yes. Who's the brother of Ari Emanuel, who is correct. The TKO CEO. Yes.
Do you think any of this matters to a significant portion of the WWE audience? Like, we've always spoken about kind of these generalities that certainly this attachment to the Trump administration has yielded strong results for the UFC. It's something that its audience has willingly accepted. It's also turned off a lot of fans too. It doesn't get as much of a focus, but it's definitely been a turnoff because it's almost one in the same that this has become a sport that is so linked to it. And WWE, throughout this entire decade now, since Trump first announced he was running for president, has been one that has greatly distanced itself from someone that it has had very close ties to in its history. But at this point, it is like, do you sense that this is something that resonates with a WWE audience that ultimately is turned off by this, is indifferent to the outward political associations with the current administration?
I think it's a pretty small percentage of the potential audience for WWE that is affected, that is changing their engagement with WWE because of this. The things that we were opening this program with, talking about how this use of uniformed military for partisan politics, this is hard enough for us to explain clearly to people why this is a big deal, I think, in this environment where norms have been worn away and eroded gradually over time. Look, Donald Trump won the popular vote, and a lot of people, including WWE fans, probably contributed to that. And I think the percentage of people who care that much that it's going to affect the degree which they engage have probably already had plenty of other reasons, maybe including the deal with Saudi Arabia to let that affect them. And then we're still talking about a really small portion of the fan base, I think.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think that there's definitely people that this stuff does affect, maybe there. I think more so it confirms what opinion they may already have of a TKO entity that understands the political dynamic. And especially, like, we are in an era where, I mean, it behooves a lot of these companies to be in lockstep with this administration. TKO is certainly not going to be an outlier in that sense. If anything, like, they are near the front of the line.
I guess, in contrast, subtracting Vince McMahon has been a bigger positive than any of this, you know, subtle association with Trump politics.
Are you surprised at all that they have invoked this portrayal of CM Punk on its television? Is there, like, it's an odd placement of a CM Punk that they have presented to their audience in going this way. Like, this is the most they have ever made of any kind of performer having an aversion to Saudi Arabia.
I wonder if they cleared that with His Excellency Turkey.
Yeah, I don't know what the response was on the Saudi Arabia side, but it's an interesting one in that, like, what is to gain from this from a WWE side of positioning this in such a way,
it's salvaging Punk's authenticity to like give people at least a surface level reason about why he's going to do this thing that he was apparently opposed to doing, that he was, you know, vilifying others for doing. And he's CM Punk, and he's somebody who's very, you know, at least outwardly the character is, and I think the person is pretty headstrong and has really clear principles. Well, why are you going to go against your principles? All right, we're at least providing a storyline reason here.
Also, days later, I mean, CM Punk, to my knowledge, like, the only person associated with WWE that was, promoting his, this was like a photo that he took. I don't think that he posted this himself, but at one of the No Kings rally that took place in Chicago as well. And I mean, this coming as, you know, he's facing like a wave of, I would at least say, like, online criticism. This is not permeated to, you know, him being booed at any of these shows for this hypocritical stance, and I don't even sense that he would get a negative reaction in Saudi Arabia, but it is one where, you know, it is definitely for those that can certainly look at his past. Like, this is the one guy on the roster that I think doing the Saudi Arabia show, it does come with a cost to his, to fans of a CM Punk, because I think they they do take him a bit more seriously when it comes to, you know, his moral stance that he has taken in the past.
Yeah. And if he's healthy, can't imagine him not doing Royal Rumble, which will also be in Riyadh.
I don't think there was, I think the second Royal Rumble was booked. It was a case of, okay, it's a question of when you are going to Saudi Arabia, not if. Like that to me was the confirmation, and they're ripping the Band-Aid off by going to this show. So there you go. That is your 1A storyline heading into Saudi Arabia next weekend. Tune in to find out if his moral compass is restored.
We can't wait to find out.
Where to go next, Brandon? We have a lot here on the docket today. We're going to move on to, let's chat about Vince McMahon, because there was no shortage of topics this week. A lot of refilings, a lot of legal fees that were probably spent over the last week or two. But also, coming courtesy of Justin Barrasso at his Undisputed newsletter on Substack, speaking with BKFC president Dave Feldman. He is the founder and president of Bare Knuckle, which is partially owned by Triller. And in speaking with Justin Barrasso, confirmed that they did have a meeting with Vince McMahon about his return to promoting. And Feldman spoke to Barrasso, stating, quote, "He's a great guy. A great guy. His whole team is great. But the timing wasn't right for us," said Feldman, who was not willing to relinquish full control of BKFC. Quote, "He's Vince McMahon. If I were him, I'd want creative control too. He was awesome, very complimentary, and he was very serious to do business." What are the odds Vince McMahon took this meeting not knowing if BKFC was worked or not?
I wouldn't completely rule it out. I think
he, like, what is creative control in a in BKFC?
Oh, it's matchmaking. It's the marketing creative. Vince loves branding and marketing, right? And I gather that Shane's involved with whatever Vince is up to these days, I gather that Shane's a big MMA fan. I bet he got him up to speed on the latest in BKFC.
I cannot imagine that Shane is not in the shadow of whatever Vince McMahon's next moves are going to be. This one screams something very much like Shane bringing up the notion of buying Pride back in 2006, right, and bringing to him the ability that they could have bought the UFC before it exploded as well. So that certainly links it toward that.
I think again, if you read this article, you definitely come away with the reinforcing the possibility to the reader that, oh, he's probably going to end up in combat sports in some form, and maybe wrestling. And there's a lot of people in wrestling who still think highly of Vince, who do not see him as a toxic figure.
No, I don't think if we had a situation where you had all of these, you know, marquee stars that were contractually available, and Vince McMahon had capital, I think they'd absolutely be sitting down to at least hear out Vince McMahon. I don't think they would have any hang up on working with a Vince McMahon. The problem is those talents do not have contracts coming due. And I don't think, like, number one, you would be starting from zero when it comes to just distribution of your product. Vince McMahon can probably get a lot of meetings. He can get a lot of funding, but the names are not out there. And quite frankly, like, the market is really not there, I think, for the appetite for yet another wrestling entity, even if you had significant money beat behind it. I don't see the pro wrestling avenue having, and also just from an ego standpoint of starting something that is going to be just like, you cannot compete with the company that you will always be associated with. Even
if you were to get back into wrestling, he would have to, this article kind of makes the right point, I think, is that he would have to acquire something existing, or it might be helpful to do so. But what would that even be? WWE, probably not. He's continuing to sell his shares in TKO.
CMLL.
Maybe Vince is really behind AEW. Maybe the
Big Japan. Big Japan. That could be his outlet.
TNA. I mean, like, Triller seems to be under immense financial pressure.
You could buy Triller probably for a very cheap amount.
That's a thought that's crossed my mind. Is he's clearly looking to do private equity investing. Triller TV will probably end up being spun out and sold off of Triller if the Triller group ends up, you know, disintegrating. They'll have to liquidate and get whatever value they can out of its parts. And so I would think, you know, maybe DAZN would be a sensible acquirer of Triller TV as well. But I wouldn't rule out any other parties who have interest in things like that. And remember, Triller TV, we should remind everybody, is not just wrestling, but it is also MMA. It's also soccer, football on there. It is not just, which is perfect for Vince, right? It's not just wrestling, pal.
So we could see, like, the idea of Vince McMahon, Triller, and Game Changer Wrestling all being under the same umbrella. Would that be preposterous?
Yes.
So we also had Vince McMahon. Let's start off with the Ring Boy lawsuit. So over the past week, Vince McMahon, Linda McMahon, and WWE all filing motions in the Ring Boy lawsuit. And essentially, they are trying to get this thrown out. And what are the key arguments that are being made by the defendants arguing to have the Ring Boy suit thrown out?
They're saying largely the same things that they were saying originally. Like the Grant case that we're going to talk about, this is not the first time that they've filed these motions, but for procedural reasons, they have to refile them. And they are a little bit different than they were in the first place. But they're saying, so we have three different parties: Vince, separate counsel; Linda, separate counsel; WWE/TKO, all separate counsel, right? So they're arguing, first of all, that we're not from Maryland. You're suing us in Maryland. What for? Well, because there's a child, child victims abuse. There's a law that has removed all of the statutes of limitations for people who allege that they were victims of child sex abuse. That has been enacted into law in the state of Maryland. The state Supreme Court heard a challenge to that and decided, no, this does properly remove all statute limitations for civil lawsuits, whether we're talking about the people who allegedly perpetrated that abuse, or whether we're talking about people that you want to hold negligent for that abuse, which is what we have here. The perpetrators themselves are deceased. Mel Phillips is deceased. Pat Patterson is deceased. But the company is still around, and Vince and Linda, who were in charge of the company at the time, are still around. So they're being sued. But they're saying, we're not from Maryland. We don't live in Maryland. We're from Connecticut. WWE is headquartered in Connecticut, and it's incorporated in Delaware. Linda acknowledges that she had an apartment in 1970 to 72 in Maryland, but that's before any of this alleged abuse happened. Now, they did do business in Maryland. Obviously, there were, I counted some 230 shows that the WWF operated in Maryland throughout the 1980s, which is the decade in which most of this abuse is alleged to have occurred. But they're saying that there's not enough of an argument to use Maryland's long arm law, I think it's called, to bring them into court. So this is a complex legal issue I'm not going to unpack here, but the judge will have to make a decision about that probably eventually. But there's other arguments too.
By the way, you read like these horrific allegations, and when one of the arguments at the end of it is, yeah, this is horrible, but we don't live in Maryland.
So I guess what if you wanted to make a charitable argument to them, they're saying, well, okay, so sue us in Pennsylvania, sue us in Connecticut, where there aren't this removal of statute of limitations. TKO is also arguing that the TKO parent company, but not necessarily the W company, the TKO parent company should be dropped from this case because you haven't shown exactly why TKO holds the liability of the World Wrestling Federation. They're also arguing, and I think this is where we get most substantive.
Yeah, we'll take all the IP, we'll take all of the contracts, we'll take all of the television deals. We'll take the assets. That's what we bought. The liabilities, they stop in 2023.
I've characterized this as possibly a magic word situation where they may actually have those liabilities, but the plaintiffs just haven't articulated in the right technical legal way yet. In any case, maybe the most substantive issue we can raise here, and by the way, WWE and Vince and Linda are very aligned here on this issue in particular, is that, you know, they're saying that, sure, you have this comment and this deposition, in fact, from Phil Mushnick, the New York Post columnist, who says that he was told in 1992 by Vince McMahon, not by somebody else, but by Vince McMahon himself, that he was aware of Mel Phillips' peculiar and unnatural interest in children. And so he was let go from the company, whatever it was, in 1988. Others would say maybe he quit, whatever the case was, he was gone. But then he was rehired about 6 weeks later under the caveat that he steer clear from children. Now, Phil Mushnick did not just write this in the New York Post. He was sued for defamation, and then he testified under oath to the same. He, in his testimony, in his deposition, he attributes that knowledge not only to Vince, but to Linda also. And
it's also worth noting in the defamation case, they never cited that as being defamatory. Like, they never challenged that assertion by Phil Mushnick that Vince McMahon had stated that to him on the record, both to him and to Dave Meltzer. These were separate reporters that Vince McMahon disclosed that 1988 incident with Mel Phillips and the caveat.
And Dave, as recently as 2020, has confirmed that, yes, that is accurate, that he was told the same. And so I think you could characterize this in one sense of, you know, look, W has done a lot to subtly distance itself from Vince McMahon. We saw all the rhetoric and presentation in Philadelphia for WrestleMania more than a year ago about this is the new era, this is the Paul Levesque era, Stephanie McMahon coming out and blessing the whole thing. And you have these, you know, this former executive and WWE are very well aligned here. And you have WWE's attorneys, saying here that the earliest that we could have known about this, that Vince McMahon or Linda McMahon could have known about this was 1992. Even if you take the Mushnick story into account, and what they're saying is you've only got one allegation here. That's after March of 1992. That's the earliest that we could have known. This was not foreseeable. We couldn't have foreseen that Mel Phillips was going to abuse people if he did, or that Pat Patterson was going to abuse someone if he did.
Although you and I have, like, directly from Nick Koniski, that he went right to Vince McMahon and said he was propositioned.
This is about sexual harassment related to Terry Garvin.
Yes.
Yeah. This is what they would say to that probably. Not that this is necessarily an issue. These are issues related to allegations against Mel Phillips and Pat Patterson. And that is a point to raise about the culture and the environment. Yeah, I think
there's at least a pattern of sexual harassment among officials that, I mean, this could not have necessarily in 1992. This is so out of character and out of left field that these allegations would be made. And I mean, in particular with Mel Phillips, I mean, this was one that, I mean, if you want to be as charitable as possible, that the locker room at the bare minimum took it as some kind of joke that he had a foot fetish, and this extended onto veiled or not so veiled references on commentary, drawings by Bret Hart that he has spoken about. The idea that Mel Phillips, like, as Jerry McDivitt always tried to kind of downplay it as just simply like, you know, just a foot fetish, but nothing that resembled, as he told David Bixenspan, non-conventional rape.
So, and I want to read, like, this is W's lawyers in 2025 saying specifically the plaintiffs claim that Vince McMahon had quote unquote eyes and ears everywhere and thus quote unquote clearly knew what was going on. That in 1988, the McMahons fired Phillips because his relationship with underage boys seemed peculiar and unnatural, and then rehired him a few weeks later with the instruction to steer clear from kids. Such vague allegations are procedurally insufficient to plead the defendants knew or should have known of instances of sexual abuse as defined by the Child Victims Act. So they're saying what you're saying isn't enough. These are vague allegations. It's not like somebody came to Vince and said, I saw Mel Phillips sexually abusing someone. So how is it foreseeable? How can we be held accountable for this?
That's the argument. And it's ultimately, it is going to come down to what is going to be proven here, I think, is much less. I've said this from the beginning. It's not determining necessarily if these actions occurred, but, and even if they did, proving that Vince McMahon and Linda McMahon had knowledge of them. And that becomes a lot trickier than simply being able to prove that they occurred. It's also establishing some kind of link that demonstrates that Vince McMahon and Linda McMahon had to have knowledge of this and either turned a blind eye to it, or in the case, when you read the lawsuit, went to such a degree that Mel Phillips had his own room set up at some of these venues and had camera equipment that he was utilizing, that there was, goes even beyond just turning a blind eye to it, but actually, like, providing this person with the necessary areas within the arena to potentially abuse children. Why were ring boys of this age being utilized by this company? Like, that's a That's a kind of just base level question. Like, why were we utilizing children for these roles? And they were children, some of them.
And to that, they say
crossing state lines.
That wasn't us. That wasn't us. That was Mel Phillips. Mel Phillips was acting of his own accord. And if he abused people in hotels, well, he did that on his own time. It was not in the scope of his employment for WWE. And in fact, here's some more distancing that he wasn't an employee. He probably wasn't. He was probably a contractor. Whatever he was doing, that was Mel Phillips doing. That was him recruiting minors. That was him paying them, if he did, in cash, allegedly, and sometimes in merchandise or in lodging or in food. That wasn't us. You know, they've got Linda's declaration and probably Vince's too, saying, I've never hired any ring boys.
Well, then. And then the next level to that is that if you believe so strongly that you had no link to this and bear no responsibility, and right through Jerry Millette is the fact that Mel Phillips received a sizable six-figure sum upon leaving. The question for me would be, why? Why did you feel compelled to pay this amount? Why did you feel
$800,000, according to Gerard Millett?
$800,000 to a non-employee, to a contractor that was in charge of the ring crew and ring announcing, required a near $1 million payoff when leaving the company. Why did that? Was there a need to rehire Tom Cole? Why were there provisions in Tom Cole's rehiring and giving him his back pay? Those are questions. You obviously assume some level of onus in like $800,000 in that time period for WWF is a gigantic amount. Like you can have fingers left over counting the number of talents that were making $800,000 in that company in 1992.
Yeah. And there may be disputes about whether he really got that payoff. And according to Gerard, who defends Mel Phillips again, he says
very
staunchly he saw the check with his own eyes. So.
The next refiling of motions relates to Janelle Grant. This is kind of a bit more straightforward. But what was the what were the filings related to in that case?
Arbitration. And this is the third time that motions to compel arbitration have been filed. What does that mean? The defendants want this case to go to arbitration, private arbitration, which is what the NDA that Janelle Grant and Vince McMahon signed includes a clause related to that. That Vince is going to pay you $3 million. You were both going to be silent about this. We're not going to sue each other. Grant agreed not to sue. And if there are any disputes about this agreement, we're going to handle it in private arbitration because we want everything to be quiet. So this is the third time this has been refiled again because of procedural issues. SDNY with the criminal investigation put this on hold until December, and then that was lifted, and then they were refiled, and then Grant amended her complaint so that changed exactly what the allegations were, so they had to refile again. And so now it's largely the same thing that's being realleged here. Taking these together, in which these were refiled days apart, it highlighted to me that it's Vince and WWE are very much aligned and are on the same side of two lawsuits. And it's not as if WWE has said, we're going to waive NDAs, and Grant's representatives have asked WWE to do that. It wouldn't be unprecedented. Similar happened in the case of Harvey Weinstein with Miramax. It's not as if WWE is doing that. And in fact, they're aligned with Vince in trying to push this off into arbitration. They argue it should go into arbitration for a variety of reasons that we've talked about before, including, I think most importantly, they're arguing that the EFAA, which is a law that allows certain cases, arbitration to not be enforced, specifically when it comes to pre-employment agreements. And WWE is arguing that this was a post-employment agreement. This was coinciding with Janelle Grant's exit from WWE. There are, and the EFAA went into effect on March 3rd, 2022, which is weeks after they actually signed the NDA. It just so happens, however, there are some allegations that were made and are alleged to have occurred after March 3rd, 2022. The Grant side has not replied to this yet. I don't know if I have the deadlines here. They have, this is actually coming up fairly soon. So Grant will be able to request motion-related discovery. And I don't want to, we'll mention, I guess, when we get to the Kolker thing too, but she'll be able to make motion related discovery. I think even if this does go to arbitration, she's going to have quite a bit of discovery. And part of the disadvantage of arbitration, especially for plaintiffs, is that you cannot get much discovery at all. Anyway, so she's going to have until next Monday, this coming Monday, to, request motion related discovery. So she's going to request evidence related to this arbitration question. And then by the 30th, that doesn't make sense. Anyway, I think I've got these transposed. And I think by the 30th, she will have to respond. And then then by July 11th, I think, the defendants will have the ability to reply. In any case, in both this case and in the Ringboy case, all the defendants have asked for, a hearing to present oral arguments where they would actually be able to argue the case to the judge. I assume the plaintiff attorneys would get to be there too, to argue their side. So this might end up coming before the judge, these complicated legal questions.
And to go over the dates again, the NDA is signed at the end of January of 2022. And then in the complaint, Grant had alleged that there was another incident involving Vince McMahon after that NDA was signed. Also coming after the NDA was signed was Vince McMahon attempting to send Janelle Grant to meet with Brock Lesnar, which ultimately did not occur. But that was something as well that's alleged to have taken place after the fact. Those could be key events if we're talking about, you know, what is relevant coming after the signing of the NDA.
And the leaking of her name in June, which she alleges is an act of retaliation on the part of WWE. For everyone keeping track on the dates here that the deadlines are expected. Plaintiffs shall file response in opposition on or before July 11th, and then the defendant's reply is due on August 1st. So if there's a hearing, it'll be after those dates.
Yes. WrestleNomics.com for a very concise timeline of events, yes, which are very key for subjects such as this. And that takes us into the Kolker case, which is a separate issue where
Number four of five today,
where Carlin Kolker is suing Ann Callis and her Holland law firm. And Janelle Grant is now seeking additional evidence against Carlin Kolker. The main thing that is brought up here is that she is requesting travel logs involving Vince McMahon and Dr. Carlin Kolker, specifically to Tijuana, Mexico, and not elaborating on what is significant about that particular area. But that's a further wrinkle to all of this.
So this is a state level case, which is different than the other cases we're talking about, which are in federal court. Dr. Carlin Kolker, who is a doctor who treats a lot of celebrities, including Vince McMahon, allegedly he sent Janelle Grant to seek treatment at this clinic. Janelle Grant alleges that she was not told what sorts of medicines or supplements she was being given. She's getting IV infusions and supplement pills. And there's this dispute over whether or not Janelle Grant has gotten all of her medical records. Kolker says he's given her all of what she's asked for multiple times. She says otherwise. Kolker tried to get this dismissed. The judge said, no, it stays. This is not quite a lawsuit yet. This is a petition, a bill discovery. This is an effort to get evidence, could turn into a lawsuit. And now we're getting the requests for evidence. The judge has to resolve whether or not this issue in particular about getting evidence can be litigated further or not. That's what the plaintiffs are asking for. But yes, they're asking for all sorts of things, including communications between Dr. Kolker and Vince McMahon, communications between WWE and Dr. Kolker, and makes a very conspicuous request for any records related to traveling that Kolker and McMahon may have had together, and specifically Tijuana, Mexico. So no explanation in the filings about what that's about.
Yeah, and Brandon wrote about this in a lot of detail up at postwrestling.com, and part of that, he writes, the defendants denied any coordination with McMahon related to Grant's care, As for the accusation that a Peak Wellness employee was involved in McMahon's alleged abuse, an allegation also included in Grant's federal case against McMahon, Kolker's legal team says the doctor learned about the allegation through media reports. Kolker emphasized that it's his understanding that it was a single off-premises encounter that the now former clinic employee said was consensual. So that was the first time Kolker has addressed this allegation by Grant that there was an incident involving another employee at Peak Wellness. She was not accusing Kolker of this, but
right.
also stating the fact that there was no coordination between Vince McMahon and Janelle Grant's care. That's a tough needle to thread when this was Vince McMahon's physician that it's alleged that other WWE talent had been recommended here, and that Vince McMahon was covering the payments here on top of it. So that's an argument that Kolker is making, but one that is kind of hard to wrap your head around.
Just add what's being referred to there is Grant in her federal lawsuit alleges among many other cases of abuse that she was assaulted by Vince and what Kolker is saying is a former employee of Peak Wellness who is not the doctor himself. So he's saying that person is no longer there, which is not something that I think was stated before.
No, it was not. Before we move on to yet another lawsuit, this is an AEW one. Tuesday marked 5 years since, if you want to look at sort of the beginning of what became known as the speaking out movement, I think there's a lot of connection to obviously the Vince McMahon story and how this has really dominated that particular subject over the last 3 years. If you recall, like speaking out, it began, if you want to call it that, surrounding David Starr. And then from there, it just became a series of stories from various performers, people connected to the industry, of incidents they had undergone. And this reached across the industry, and it was pretty surreal just to see all of these coming out and all of these instances. I think it most centered around the European wrestling scene. I think some companies that have never recovered from this fully. And this is right in the midst of the pandemic as well. Just some of your thoughts, Brandon, about kind of like where we are 5 years later and how you look back at this particular time period where it felt like it was this movement to be a significant change agent within the industry. And it certainly ended a lot of careers as well. But here we are 5 years later. Do you feel like overall there is a better handle on this, or has it sort of just resumed business as usual, where there is still the, I guess, for people that are victims of these situations that are still in a position where, man, do I speak up about something like this and potentially affect my role with a company, with a powerful figure? And is there that same level of confidence that these companies are monitoring this at a more heightened level than previous to the speaking out movement?
I would think in a sense that some are more sensitive to this than they were before. But I think what this movement was, you know, it's easier to come out in numbers, and I'm sure it's still extremely hard to come forward alone. So this happened in the sort of the early days of COVID, when wrestling was basically shut down, at least almost all the indies were. I was not much involved in independent wrestling after this, so I can't say much about firsthand experience. But I mean, think about who the biggest names are whose careers mostly have come to an end. And that's, as you mentioned, David Starr, Marty Scurll, Joey Ryan. I look at Matt Riddle as somebody who was just over the peak of where this would have really destroyed his career. And he's had his own issues in addition to speaking out allegations.
This coincided with his main roster call up was
when- exactly what I'm saying is that he was on, if you're on national television, you could get a better chance of surviving this. But if you were reliant on indie work, and indie work is overwhelmingly promoted by social media, I think you were in a lot more trouble.
Yeah. I think that there is certainly a frustration among some that there it becomes very difficult because a lot of these cases, I mean, they were not so much on the promotions to litigate. I mean, ultimately, they are the arbiters of who they're going to hire or not book. But a lot of it was left to allegations that were put out, and your audience was left to kind of have to arbitrate these online. And that became kind of the decision. And it was which performers would you be comfortable using and which you would not. Like, people might forget this, but when New Japan during the pandemic and they're filming their Strong series in empty arenas in LA, they tried to use Marty Scurll and they were so concerned about the word getting out. And then when it did get out, there was such a backlash that New Japan realized we cannot use Marty Scurll, and he's largely been confined to taking shots in Mexico during this time period. There are others that have, you know, it's a very difficult system of like audiences that are either.
Yeah, for Marty Scurll, I'm seeing a lot of Brazil, Mexico, Denmark, Saudi Arabia, an indie show in Saudi Arabia, Germany, Austria. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and Marty Scurll was one where, I mean, there were like Ring of Honor did internal investigations, and Marty Scurll was very significant into ROH's plans when the pandemic hit. Not only had he signed there, and he was also like in a booking position as well. So he was figured in significantly, but they
investigated. You could easily see in AEW today.
100%. It was, you know, and the thought was when this guy's contract comes due with Ring of Honor, he's going to be in great demand, not just with AEW, NXT, like, and Ring of Honor. Like, you could have had all these players vying for him.
Because both him and Joey Ryan are people who are prominent on the All In show.
Very much, yeah. If you remember, like, being the Elite, they took down episodes of involving Joey Ryan on top of it. I mean, and then you had Ring of Honor, like, they cut ties with Marty Scurll, and also after allegations against Dan Moff. And Dan Moff is about to work in the main event of this Maple Leaf Pro Wrestling show coming up on July the 5th. And I think it's a lot of fans that maybe there was such a proliferation of all of these allegations. I don't know how many fans were able to even keep track of some of these when we're going back all of these years later. I think you would ultimately have to go on a case by case basis of different locker rooms around the country, especially on the European scene. Like, how much has it changed? Is it still the cult?
Where you have social relationships, it's very hard for people to look at their friend and who's accused of terrible things and to still say no. And I think it's, I mean, let's look at all the people who are still supportive of events, you know, who's been alleged of some of the worst things we've ever read. And, you know, if he somehow, you know, could get around the issue of everybody being under contract, I think he would not have that hard of a time to find people to work for him. So I think that the social relationships, and this is not a good thing, overcome these issues for a lot of people. And it's easier, again, it's easier for many people to come forward. But it's still, I think this is an industry that is overwhelmingly, it's a subjective industry based on performance and based largely on social relationships. And you can look at WWE as well. And what we mentioned earlier, it's not like WWE has said, yes, we're waiving all the NDAs. We're reflecting on this and we're going to try to move past this. They're still very much aligned in a legal defense with someone who, to their fan-facing audience and to their business partner audience, they want to distance themselves from.
Yeah, and just my final thoughts on this. Like, this is professional wrestling, and this is an industry that, above all else, it's going to be what is the value versus what is the risk of this person. And that's always going to be the calculus of, like, a WWE. Like, we can look at, would they have used an Alberto El Patron? It's like, as soon as that word got out, boom, they just realized, man, this is too controversial a figure for our audience that they just seem to just want no connection to at this point. But that's like your level of value to a company is going to be what is going to, I think, determine sort of how a promoter is going to think about these people. Is this going to turn off more people than it's going to sell tickets to? And at least as we're talking like the independent level where that's part of the calculus. And I think as well for people that are victims that are looking at, you know, where like to share these stories, it's to understand number one, that I am going to undergo unmitigated harassment online when I put forward an allegation. And number two, opening myself up to potential legal repercussions. Like the system is created to keep these allegations quiet and private because you are putting your neck out there to go public with this. So I think the people that did, they deserve a lot of credit because I think all these years later, there is definitely the question of has this industry moved commensurate to this movement that occurred 5 years ago and coming at a time when it is so divisive to introduce this online where you are just going to be just steamrolled by people online that will come at you.
And I was just, WWE would probably say, you know, if they were defending themselves, if they were actually to discuss this, that, hey, look at other sports. And let's say you're familiar with UFC. If there were, you know, if there were sexual misconduct allegations against UFC fighters, would they no longer be allowed to fight in UFC?
Not necessarily. No.
And I think like, that's like, similar.
Look at Conor McGregor. I mean, right. would again, and this goes to the star power. If this is,
look at Dana White. I'm not that Dana White. Not he's accused of sexual misconduct, but he's on video slapping his wife.
Like again, if this is a 2-2 fighter on your roster, that's a random bantamweight. But yeah, it's probably a pretty much a flip of the coin of the do we book this guy or don't book this guy. But if he's of value to us, and Conor McGregor obviously is, and I can't even say that UFC is like from a moral standpoint, sure, but from a just business standpoint, like listen to the dialogue around Conor McGregor. If you don't think Conor McGregor being announced tomorrow to fight, despite what his rap sheet is and just accused of some of the most horrific things imaginable and going through a trial last year of which he was found liable, there would still be a gigantic demand to see Conor McGregor fight. And that's on the public, that if you are a star, that is going to overcome a lot, that you are going to have that ability to overcome some of the most egregious affronts.
And I think if we're talking about like the NFL or something like that, well, maybe if Conor McGregor was a star NFL player, I don't know that he would still find a team that would sign him. But you wouldn't have, I think W would say, look, you know, Enzo was accused of something and we fired him. Maybe it's partly because he didn't tell us about it. But you know, Enzo was accused of misconduct and they fired him. This is all before speaking out. Whereas if you had allegations like that against, you know, an NFL player or a major sports star in the US, I think that player would still be playing today.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Well, there's we got to get back to our lawsuits because we still have more to go. We're going to move on over to this AEW suit that was recently filed over an incident. Oh, we have two more. My mistake. I lost count. So this is over an incident from a episode of Dynamite on May 10th, 2023 at the Little Caesars Arena in Detroit, Michigan, during a steel cage match between Kenny Omega and Jon Moxley, where the defendant, Christopher Despenza, was working as an independent contractor for a company that had been that AEW had hired to work on production. And it sounds like he had worked multiple shows for AEW. It wasn't just this isolated night, but he was not an employee of AEW. So there's a spot in the match, and you can watch this. AEW has the clip literally on its YouTube channel where Moxley is on the floor and he grabs a screwdriver from Dispenza's back pocket, and after taking it, shoves Dispenza to the ground. And Dispenza has alleged that he required multiple surgical procedures, including cervical spine surgery, shoulder surgery, and sustained other serious injuries that necessitate significant medical treatment. In the case, he is arguing that this is in excess of $150,000 in damages that he has sustained, with a whole host of problems that he has sustained from all of this. But this is kind of surprising that this got this far, that this couldn't have just been rectified if there were, you know, medical issues, and that AEW would, like, Moxley should not have put his hands on this guy. I think most people can agree to that. And this is like the weird gray area of pro wrestling, of a guy that in character, I don't think there was necessarily malice behind Moxley's actions, or this was premeditated, but in the moment, he just shoved the guy that you kind of assume as a production member, you become part of the show, but you're not part of the show. You are there for a specific task, and they kind of blurred the line here by having him, you know, having this weapon as the prop that he was going to just have a natural reason to, why is there a screwdriver at ringside? Well, it's in the production guy's back pocket, and getting shoved to the ground.
Yeah. It's to your point, being surprised that it got this far. I think it's notable that this became a public story just the other day.
We should credit John Elba, who first reported this over at the Takedown on SI.com. Yeah.
So John Elba reports this 2 days ago on the 16th. This lawsuit was filed on May 30th. This is at the state level. If it was at the federal level, it probably would have come up on some of our searches and our alerts. So it's hard to find lawsuits that are at the state level. This is in Wayne County Circuit Court. So this was out there for some 16, 17 days before there was reporting on it. So I don't know if that has to do with settlement talks or not, obviously, but it leads one to wonder that. Do you remember last time? I don't know how many times John Moxley and Kenny Omega have had matches, but there was, I think, the time in Baltimore where they had like a no DQ match. I think it was on a pay-per-view or something. And
yes, the first Full Gear.
And they were fined by the Maryland Commission for the bleeding, I think, or something. So bad things happen when Kenny Omega and Moxley have a match. I guess, you know, the challenge from AEW will be, you're telling me that only because of this shove that you had to have neck surgery. Were there no other medical conditions that you were already dealing with? It doesn't make it right, but not surprising to me that a wrestler, it just feels like a very indie wrestling thing, or just general wrestling thing to do, especially if you're a heel. And according to the plaintiff's account here, he was not told that he was going to be shoved. He was told that he was going to hand this screwdriver over to the wrestler, and that would be that. And then, of course, he shoved him and had to, you know, it just feels like something that, oh yeah, somebody got really into the performance and had to be in character and give this guy a big shove that he wasn't expecting.
I should correct myself. I said in excess of $150,000. That was a previous lawsuit. They're arguing this is in excess of $25,000. That he's seeking a jury trial for this, but believes that the damages should be in excess of $25,000. So we're not talking about a crazy amount that he is seeking. But I think that's at the crux of this. If I was AEW's defense here, would be, well, what kind of health was this production member in prior? Did he have any history of shoulder problems, of cervical issues, that it would be hard to imagine that this landing would have necessitated such damage that he is alleging? That would be my defense to all of this. There's also like citations here in this complaint of past disciplinary offenses by Moxley, including a documented history of unpredictability, as well as a lack of control by the defendant AEW, all of which were known or should have been known to AEW at the time of this assault, and that AEW's negligence was a proximate cause of the plaintiff being seriously injured. So
do we know of any disciplinary action?
We don't know of any of these. I mean, if they're...
I've heard people speculate that they're talking about kayfabe on screen.
Well, that's definitely what it feels like here. Like, this feels very much part and parcel of the John Moxley on-screen character of unpredictability. because, yeah, to my knowledge and to anyone else that has kind of covered this, is not aware of any kind of disciplinary offenses that Moxley has committed in the past.
Right. It's not like he was part of Brawl Out or something like that.
No. I don't know. I don't see this one going as far as of a jury trial. But if you are AEW, it might just be a pause of who is – like, it's one thing when you have – an employee of the company that is, you know, your ringside timekeeper or something that we're going to do a bump with.
These will be extras who have indie wrestling experience from now.
Well, that's it. And, yeah. You know, your independent contractors that are there as production members are probably not people that we have to be setting up for any kind of involvement in the show so that you avoid someone just, you know, going like, this is Moxley just, you know, what would my character do in this moment? It's shoving him down. But like, you can't be just putting your hands on people. And I brought this up with Way on Monday night, but you and I were both there at the press conference with Chris Jericho, where it's the exact same kind of scenario where he takes his bat at the press conference and swats a water bottle into the media area and nails John Muse right in the face, like just a few feet away from us. And there's an incident.
Drew Blood.
So, I mean, yeah, also.
And John seemed to be like totally fine with it and in good spirits, but he drew blood. Yeah.
Like that is one where like is a media member going into a press conference thinking that I might become like physically involved here or hurt covering a press conference. Like it's just stuff like that, that I feel like if you are AEW, like you just can't be going that direction because you're opening yourself up to this when you're talking about physicality on unwilling participants.
Yeah. As a performer, I feel like you are so, it's so ingrained into you oftentimes to not worry about that, to not think about that. Wrestling's supposed to be this wild and crazy thing where you just get super into the character and the hell with the rest. And you're not thinking about legal liability. You know,
yeah,
that's the history of wrestling. To think about like the all of the similar things that must have happened, like in the territory days and things like this.
You imagine Brody or the Sheik,
right? Exactly. I mean, what would Bruiser Brody do?
Yeah, yeah. All those outstanding suits that people getting slapped by Inoki would have had at their dispense. Anyway, we'll see where that case goes, and let's continue. We have one more case that was dug up by the one and only David Bixenspan. I think this is just scrolling away one night on Pacer, and came across Kevin Gill, who filed a lawsuit last November against GCW and Brett Hoffman. Who's Brett Hoffman?
That apparently Brett Lauderdale is a stage name, is a work name, brother. Yeah.
Are you going to tell us your real name?
It's Brandon Thurston. I won't show you my ID because there might be issues with that. But my real name, my legal name, is Brandon Thurston. Yeah.
Okay.
I did show you my ID at that baseball game you went to.
That's true. I can confirm he is Brandon Thurston. So this, I'm surprised we don't get more of wrestling Patreon lawsuits. I mean,
we're experts to discuss this, I think.
Yes, we can confirm Patreon does take 10%. So Gil is alleging that so GCW launched a Patreon in May of 2020. So this is GCW is not able to basically run any events or at least sell tickets for in the pandemic. So they launch a Patreon, likely just to create some revenue for them during a time when they're not taking in any money outside of, they did some of those empty gym shows that were being streamed on Triller and such. So Kevin Gill helped them launch this. And
Kevin Gill was their commentator at the time.
Kevin Gill was their commentator at the time and then started hosting some of these shows for them on their Patreon. And Gill provides the screenshot of him and Brett Lauderdale agreeing that Gill would get 20% of whatever the Patreon generates on a monthly basis. And by July, he was getting paid about $1,000 per month. But then as he saw the Patreon grow, his calculations were he should have been getting like $2,000 to $3,000 per month when this Patreon was generating between $10,000 to $15,000 per month. Gill agreed to defer his payment so that money could be put back into the company. But then during this time, he observed Lauderdale buying a second home, a luxury SUV, and other luxury items, and believes were purchased with GCW assets and or Patreon funds. So he sent an invoice to Lauderdale in September of 2022 for his outstanding payments that were owed for the last 4 months of 2020. And then he alleges that Lauderdale avoided Gill for a series of weeks. He continued to work without compensation until October 13th of 2022, which is when Kevin Gill states that he was locked out of the Patreon and could not log in. And Gill was thus terminated by GCW. He states he was paid just under $4,000 on November 10th of 2022, but was still owed an outstanding figure. And Lauderdale, according to Gill, offered him a very low figure for the remainder of his work that he had not been paid for. So Gill believes that he is owed 20% of the Patreon over 22 months, and that he believes he is owed about $150,000 and is seeking the costs, expenses, punitive damages, and other relief that the court finds equitable. So he also alleges he was disparaged by GCW, both by a tweet by Brett Lauderdale that Gill was still employed by the company when he was not, stating that that prohibited him from finding work elsewhere in wrestling when people thought he was under contract to GCW, and being disparaged on a GCW broadcast a year ago with one of its commentators joking about firing him.
Yes. So I understand this coincides with Kevin Gill no longer being the commentator for GCW, who I understand has been a divisive commentator.
Some really enjoy his commentary and others don't. He was definitely like a polarizing voice for GCW fans.
Right. So if we look at, I guess the question is how much money are they really talking about here? This is where our Patreon expertise will come into play. There's a great website called Graftreon, which I think is just scraping everybody's Patreon to see how many paid subscribers you have or paid members you have over time. And this, you know, so he's saying that he launched it, and that doesn't seem to be in dispute, right? And he launched it, and you know, this peaked at just under 500 members. So
that's January 2022. So that also would have coincided with their Hammerstein show as well. And you could argue GCW was sort of, I think, at its kind of peak when it came to audience interest for that Hammerstein show.
So that's how many members they have, but there's different price points. So doing the math here, they've got a huge, you know, range of money that Kevin Gill
says. A plus for whoever tiered these. Sponsor a child, gang affiliated, or you could be a shot caller.
The gang affiliate price point is $6.66. This has become an advertisement for their Patreon. Our advertisement will come later. So we need
a lawsuit.
It sounds like he's owed some money. He's saying that his name was continued to be used after he was no longer around, and I think he wants money for that too.
And his past shows are still up there as well.
Right. Right. So I think that will be harder to argue, but it does sound like he's owed some money here. And it would not surprise me if an independent wrestling company like GCW paid people on a delayed basis. And that led to some procrastination around getting paid here or something like that. When, you know, there's exhibits in this complaint of what looks like a Facebook message between Brett Lauderdale and Kevin Gill, where they agree to 20% cut.
All right. So again, that was filed in November. So this case is still ongoing, and you can seek out the case yourself. Yeah, but it does include, you know, screenshots of the discussions. Like it's very clearly stated of, you know, Gill being promised like 20% at the beginning of this venture, and both sides not knowing like whether this Patreon will be successful or not, but agreeing to a 20% fee. So, I mean, it did incentivize Kevin Gill to put a lot of work into this if he was going to get a percentage rather than a flat rate every month.
In the big picture of GCW, this is probably pretty minor. Both of our Patreons have more members than this Patreon.
Well, you and I have no agreement on percentages, correct?
And we're not very rich here at this moment anyway.
All right, final couple of stories here. TKO has appointed a senior vice president of government affairs. You didn't apply for this role, correct?
I do not apply for jobs at companies that I cover.
A press release was issued on Tuesday, and it stated that in this newly created role, Garfield will lead the company's government affairs activities globally, reporting to Seth Krauss, who is the chief administrative officer and senior counsel to the board of directors and senior management. previously, Garfield had worked at Netflix. He had also been appointed by Barack Obama to one of its councils as well, back during the Obama administration, obviously. Garfield will lead a team responsible for public policy initiatives and political engagement, as well as support of TKO's subsidies and incentive efforts. So I feel this is going to be one of those names that pops up every now and then and is going to be probably someone of a significant force behind the scenes when it comes to a lot of TKO's overseas initiatives, when it comes to site fees, working hand in hand with governments and potentially aligning talent to go sing happy birthday at various army celebrations.
Perhaps. I mean, in the press release, there, part of the quote from Seth Krause mentions their international partnerships with Western Australia, Abu Dhabi, which is a UFC relationship, Saudi Arabia, as well as domestically in Minnesota, New Jersey, California. I would guess that, well, there's SummerSlam coming up, and they've got the NJSEA involved with that as well.
UFC is going to Azerbaijan events this weekend for the first time as well. So that's another region. So,
yeah, I mean, this is putting more executive power behind their goal to increase site fees.
And then we also have, just finishing up here, Dana White has confirmed that the TKO boxing entity, its name will be Zuffa Boxing. And this will kick off with the Canelo Alvarez-Terrence Crawford fight on September 13th, which they are holding they're doing two press conferences this weekend at Fanatics. They're doing a SummerSlam press conference on Saturday, and then they are doing a Zuffa Boxing press conference on Sunday to kick off the promotion for Canelo and Terrence Crawford. But yes, this was reported by Sports Business Journal, who reached out to Dana White, and his response by text was, yes, it is Zuffa. Mm-hmm. Very in-depth answer from Dana White.
Confirmation on the record.
There you go. You got the name of it yourself for Sports Business Journal.
Should we take these two UFC related?
Yes,
I think these are super chats. Andrew says a key point about UFC. I think it has become a haven for fascists. That is his opinion.
So we didn't talk about this, but last week, this is not related to UFC, but it does kind of tell you the what kind of brand MMA is becoming an outlet for. So last week, Russell Brand, who has been accused of rape and assault, all of a sudden popped up as kind of an ambassador at a PFL event. And whatever you want to say is that if you are facing the most horrific of charges and you want to find a sport to attach yourself to for character rehabilitation, where there's going to be an audience of largely indifference, MMA is your sport, okay? And that's becoming very, very apparent. This comes after Andrew Tate was welcomed by Dana White at a recent UFC pay-per-view. This is where, I mean, some of the, these figures, like, this is the sport that is going to be the most welcoming to figures that just to me would not be welcomed at all at a lot of other sports or entertainment vehicles.
But they still find sponsors, and their sponsors are paying a lot more than WB.
Yes. If you're in the market for an anti-woke razor, UFC will get you on the right track to make sure that you can find, like, who wants to be shaving and be worried about being woke? I mean, you've just woken up. Do you want to be re-woke when you've just woken up?
That's a good point. Yeah. Jake from Windy City says, with more and more responsibilities Dana White is taking up with boxing, along with power slaps. Power slaps still going? It's the biggest sport in the world, right? Is his heart not in it anymore with the UFC?
Yeah, so this has been a topic that has just come up more and more with the lack of appearances Dana White has been making, especially during his usual fight week responsibilities at press conferences, even the post-fight pressers. He missed one recently in Montreal. He is also involved with this new energy drink that he's launching that is taking up a significant amount of his time. He was at the big parade over the weekend in Washington.
What parade was that?
This I think was much more. I mean, it was under the guise of the Army's birthday, which also happened to be Donald Trump's birthday. So wouldn't you know, they got to celebrate together with tanks in Washington, going head to head with the No Kings parades nationwide.
Yes, he was there.
There you go. Yes, there he was. Front and center, rather than being in Atlanta for the big Kamaru Usman fight with Joaquin Buckley. I think it's very apparent that Dana White is, I think, someone that TKO understands the brand that Dana White is, that he is going to be still the person that is most associated with TKO. But like, his interests have been sliced up to such a degree that UFC is taking up less and less of a percentage of his day-to-day duties. He is not just what we have just listed of these entities that he's involved with. He is going to be full force into this Zuffa boxing deal that's going to take up, to me, way more of his bandwidth. He is on the board of directors for Meta. He has spread his wings well beyond the UFC. And for most people, like, Hunter Campbell is the day-to-day guy at this point. He is the one that is negotiating with a lot of the fighters. And he is, I think, picked up a lot of the day-to-day responsibilities that a Dana White previously held. But I think to TKO, they still want Dana to be their front-facing individual for a lot of reasons. Like, this, in the run-up of the UFC, like, the consistency has been Dana White as its top star in many ways. And I don't see Dana White ultimately like stepping down from this role, but I think you can see it's a much more disengaged Dana White than at any time during his tenure as CEO of this company.
Yeah. I don't have much to add to that, but yeah.
All right. Anything else you wanted to touch upon, Brandon?
Did we cover all the lawsuits? Streaming has exceeded traditional TV, finally. Not 5 years ago when everybody said it did, but it has, finally, according to the Nielsen Gauge. There was more streaming watch time last month than cable and broadcast combined. They were essentially equal, but streaming edged it out.
What does that mean for AEW?
Well, hopefully they stay on Max. That's what it means. I heard Tony Khan said the WBD split will not affect AEW.
Okay. Well, imagine if he had said the opposite.
Will affect AEW.
This is going to be tough. Yeah, but there you go. Like, this is notable. The fact this is the first time that, you know, streaming has, you know, outpaced, you know, broadcast and cable television. And I think you're only going to see this gap continue to widen. And this is going to be a much less profitable business for a lot of these cable companies. The glory days of 2015, they're in the rearview mirror.
Something interesting to know is, like, so where is the growth coming from? If you look at the year-over-year differences that I've calculated here in the data that Nielsen has disclosed, it looks like Netflix is pretty flat. I mean, they're not diminishing, but they're, in the last couple of months, year-over-year, they're down a little bit in terms of the percentage points. There's some other platforms that are growing also, who are taking up a larger portion of the pie, but YouTube is the biggest grower. So it's nice to be on Netflix, but really the best place to be is on YouTube, where we are.
That's right. I mean, we're key influencers when it comes to the growth of YouTube. So you know what? I'm sure the check's in the mail. That will bring an end to the show. So thank you to everyone for joining us. Next week, we will be back same time, Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. We will be heading in to the Saudi Arabia show, Night of Champions. So maybe we'll touch a bit more upon that topic and what other lawsuits are filed over the next week. There were quite a plethora of them to get through this particular week. Brandon Thurston is the man to keep you up to date on all of the legal filings throughout the pro wrestling world with a fine tooth comb.
Yeah. Expecting a grant request for general grant request for discovery on Monday. So we'll have that to talk about at least.
So look forward to that. Also, I'm going to plug some of Brandon's work. Of course, most people consume Brandon's work here on the podcast or his written work, both at WrestleNomics.com and PostWrestling.com. But this coming Friday, he will be joining WH Park for a special edition of the Long and Winding Royal Road. And we are going to get Brandon's uncensored thoughts on Kerry Von Erich's lonely NWA title defense during his 3-week run as champion, when he ventured to Japan taking on Jumbo Tsuruta just 2 days before he would drop that belt back to Ric Flair.
Yes. Yes. Kerry Von Erich's very brief NWA title run after winning it at Texas Stadium. One of his defenses. And you know, according to Cage Match, this is his second best singles match of all time against Jumbo Tsuruta in 1984 in Japan, in Tokyo. It's in Ota Ward, I think.
Yeah, I think this was at the Denon Coliseum,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, yes.
So
yes.
There you go. That's going to be coming out Friday on the Post Wrestling Feed, WH Park, and Brandon Thurston. I will be back tonight with Wei Ting sometime around 10:30 p.m. Eastern time, because we have a 2.5 hour edition of Grand Slam Mexico, as we are going to be getting AEW's first show at Arena Mexico. Man, we didn't even talk about this topic. This is we're going to do a sidebar here at the end. We do have movement in the direction of the elusive 2 hour SmackDown format.
Oh, that's right.
We totally skimmed over this. So USA Network's schedule is listing SmackDown for 2 hours on July 4th. It is, and PW Insider has reported that this is the move back to 2 hours for the program. USA is also launching a new series called The Rainmaker, nothing to do with Kazuchika Okada, on August 15th at 10 p.m. Eastern time. So I have reached out to the USA Network and WWE. I am sure that I'm just moments away from getting a direct response to this. But as of right now, all we can go by here is the schedule here of there is a 2 hour SmackDown listed for July 4th. Will that be in effect permanently after that? It would seem by August 15th that SmackDown would be at least 2 hours on USA. Although again, until this happens,
this is showing Resident Alien, but you're saying it's a different show.
That's July 4th. August 15th is this new Rainmaker show that's premiering. Yes.
Okay.
But
are you going to review that show?
Resident Alien, not a prayer.
Or Rainmaker?
No, definitely not. There is nothing I want to watch for 3 hours straight on a Friday night or any night, to be quite honest with you. Nor 4 hours.
Is there a tie-in that they could achieve if they signed Kazuchika Okada, if they had signed him to help promote with their partner here?
No. The best they could do is the Reigns Maker, perhaps a Roman return on that August 15th.
Would that have been a trademark that they wouldn't have been able to wrest away from New Japan?
Probably. If only we could have a lawsuit over the Rainmaker. That would be glorious. But there you have it. The status of SmackDown.
There it is.
Yep. Any other thoughts? Did you watch any pro wrestling over the past week?
I don't think so. The last full match I've watched is Kerry Von Erich versus Jumbo Tsuruta, that's for sure.
You know, we have gotten questions of late about having you on to like review some wrestling shows, and I just feel like I can't put Brandon through that.
Are people asking about that?
Oh, people have sent in questions to us about Brandon. So
I'm not opposed. I'm not opposed. It's something. We've mentioned a time or two, and I've turned the PLEs on, I turned the pay-per-views on and stuff, and I put them on in the background. It does sound like quite a job to have to take notes and then review a show, spend a couple hours reviewing a show afterward. So that seems like hard work.
It's long work. I'll tell you that. You're definitely wondering where your life is disappearing to.
The deathbed hours of Monday Night Raw.
Yeah. Yes. This is the part of the show where we start to get the, oh, big deal. Watching wrestling. What a tough job. No one's accusing us of acquiring a black lung from this work. So we'll stop it at that. But we thank all of you for joining us, for the super chats, for the angry tweets. We appreciate all of them. I digest it all in. It all keeps us sane. You can go support our Patreons at patreon.com/postwrestling, patreon.com/wrestlenomics. As has been disclosed in filings, Patreon get 10%. So help us out, folks. Keep the trains rolling. And that is going to conclude this edition of Pollock and Thurston. We'll speak with you next week.
Is that a bridge too far, or are they just fine with that?
Yeah, I think it would be much smarter of Trump to try to say, I'm the one trying to be the peacemaker here. Elon Musk, he's the one that has had this heel turn, but I'm still the face, to use in wrestling parlance.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.